Okay. Welcome everyone to the kickoff lecture for the, we call it the spring semester, right David? Winter slash spring semester. We're really glad to see a great turnout tonight. Thanks so much for attending. And as everybody knows, we are dedicated to bringing glossy ideas, interesting concepts, intellectual discussion to an interested audience in the DFW area. I'm Rob Olson, and once again, appreciate everyone coming out tonight. We meet on the second and fourth Tuesday of every month from September through May. The fourth Tuesday in May, we're going to have a special event. We're going to have Jeopardy Round 2. So we're going to bring Jeopardy back. We already bought the software and the hardware, and we've got our own Alex Trebek over here. And he even looks a little bit like Alex Trebek. He has more hair than Alex Trebek. And so we're going to have that again. So that, what is the date on that, David? The 26th. So put it on your calendars. It's a lot of fun. We're going to have three colleges. There'll be a professor who will be the coach, and then two students. And it was a very enjoyable experience. We got all the technological issues resolved, right, Kim?
Pretty much.
So we're in good shape there. So put it on your calendars, and we hope to see you there. We'll talk more about it. You know, there's some opportunities to make some donations as well. So anyway, we see a lot of new faces tonight. So who would have some, just to raise a hand, first-time visitors? Okay, that's awesome. So how did you all hear about us? Over here.
Internet?
Well, I heard of that thing. All right. Meetup or just Google or Meetup? Okay. Okay. Anyone else?
Just Google.
Just Google? Okay. Just Google Dallas Philosophy? Something like that? Okay.
Philosophy Club, yeah.
Philosophy Club. Okay. Great. Anybody else hear about us through Meetup? Okay. Several of you. So welcome. Any students tonight? Just a few students? Okay. What are you students at?
County Community College.
Okay, great. Quad C, right? Okay, great. And you're from Richardson?
Richardson High School.
Richardson High School, very good. And perhaps a budding philosopher as well. Any other students? Okay, yeah, where are you student at?
We're all three homeschooled.
Oh, homeschooled, okay, very good. Excellent. So your parents are a teacher, spending any time in philosophy? Okay, co-ops. Okay, very good. Excellent. So our esteemed treasurer, David Alkeck, some of you might have missed coming in, but the charge is $5 for the lecture, and we rely on the honor system. So if you haven't paid when you came in, please pay when you leave. Or if you're a student, it's $2, student with an ID. But if you don't have your ID, we trust you. Unless you're old like me, then we'll have to get some ID. And then if you want to subscribe for the spring semester, get a $10 discount, it's $35 for the whole set of lectures. And then also, please remember to pay your meal when you leave and tip your, I don't know, are they putting the tips automatically in the bills? They're not, okay, so tip your waitstaff generously. And every once in a while, someone will forget to pay, and then it comes on us. We have to pay. We're not for profit. And as David often says, philosophy is not free, so it's inexpensive. It's inexpensive at $5 to hear the quality speakers that we get, particularly the quality speakers we get tonight. So please remember that. And we have a spring schedule out. It's still kind of a work in progress. There's one or two things we need to make some changes, and one of them is TBD, but in 2 weeks we hope that we're going to have it all fleshed out. But we have topics on religion, always a popular one, on metaphysics, mental health, the nature of, I love this title, the nature of reality and the reality of nature. Skip Kilmer, one of our esteemed members, will be speaking on that. We have the Poet Laureate from Oklahoma. That's going to be pretty cool. We had a Poet Laureate from Texas a while back. I didn't know they had poetry in Oklahoma, but I guess they do. They don't have it from Nebraska. They don't have any poetry in Nebraska. What makes Jewish thought Jewish? That's going to be really fascinating. and religion and political consciousness in a post-secular age. There's all sorts of things. Neuroscience, conservative antiquity.
Montesquieu
as conservative liberal. So pass the information on to your friends and family, and we hope to see you come out as many lectures as possible. We've got a website with the same information, and so you can go in and www.philosophyforum.org to see that. And if anyone is interested in helping us out, with volunteering with AV and with any of the social media, we're always looking for some help there. So tonight we have our speaker. He'll speak for approximately 45 minutes, and we'll open it up to questions. And often the questions, that's some of the best, often is the best part of or one of the better parts of the whole presentation. And then lastly, please turn off your cell phones or put them on vibrate mode at this time. And now it's my honor to introduce our speaker. We're privileged to have Dr. Justin Fisher with us tonight. Dr. Fisher is a philosophy professor at Southern Methodist University here in Dallas. His PhD is from the University of Arizona. His research interests center on philosophy of the mind and cognitive science. Dr. Fisher has published papers on these and related topics in various journals, including Philosophical Studies, NOAS, Philosophical Psychology, and the British Journal for Philosophy of Science. He's also the proud father-to-be. We're honored to have his wife with us. He's the proud father-to-be of an infant who is currently estimated to be T-minus 3 weeks old. So that is really, really cool. Do we know what gender, or is it a secret?
It's a boy.
Okay, he's going to have another philosophy professor down the road. Dr. Fisher will be speaking this evening on whether or not we have a prudential reason and have reasons to believe in God. And now please join me in welcoming Dr. Justin Fisher.
You should be good.
Am I on here?
Well,
I'm good. Okay, great. Great. Well, thank you very much for having me here. I'm not all that accustomed to giving talks in philosophy of religion, though this one overlaps philosophy of religion with some epistemology or theory of knowledge stuff that I know a bit more about. But I guess it's customary in religious settings to start out with some sort of reading from some sort of holy text or something. So so I chose my favorite authoritative book. So we'll start with a reading from this.
Well, that is Calvin.
Yeah. Calvinism. Okay, so the boy Calvin said, "Gosh, Hobbes, what if I don't get any presents this year because I doubted the existence of Santa? Suppose he's putting my name on the bad list right now. That would be awful." After much gnashing of teeth, Calvin announced, "Well, I've decided I do believe in Santa, no matter how preposterous he sounds." The tiger Hobbes asked him, "Well, what convinced you?" And Calvin says, "A simple risk analysis." "I want presents, lots of presents. Why risk not getting them over a matter of belief? Heck, I'll believe anything they want." So Hobbes observed, "How cynically enterprising of you." Calvin, being young and rash, mistook the tiger's cautionary advice as a sign of approval instead, and he says, "That's the spirit of Christmas." Okay, so that concludes our reading. I might skip that one now. Good. So hopefully that sort of argument is pretty familiar. Probably many of you have already encountered Pascal's Wager by Blaise Pascal, which he's basically the father of doing risk analysis. And this is an argument that Pascal gave for believing in the existence of God. Of course, in Pascal's case, it was God and going to heaven in your afterlife rather than Santa Claus and getting a bunch of presents under the tree. But basically, the structure of the argument is just the same in both cases. So here's a quote from Pascal. Pascal says, "Either God is or he is not. Either he exists or he doesn't. To which side shall we incline? Which of these should we believe?" As far as Pascal could tell, he thought that our evidence couldn't decide between these two. Pascal, it seemed like he thought it was pretty much 50-50 whether or not God exists or doesn't exist if you're just taking the evidence into account. But Pascal said, well, maybe we can approach this a different way. He had quite a few friends who are gamblers, and they called upon Pascal's mathematical expertise to help them figure out, you know, which bets they ought to take and stuff like that. And Pascal said, well, let's use that sort of reasoning. Let's apply that to the question of whether or not we should believe that God exists. So let's weigh the potential gains and losses that are involved. He says, well, if you gain, if you believe in God and end up being right, you'll gain all. You'll get afterlife in heaven. And if you lose, you know, at some points he says you lose nothing. At other points it seems like he's acknowledging that maybe religion is a little bit costly, but compared to the chance of getting a very good and infinitely good afterlife in heaven, the costs of religion are very pale in comparison. So Pascal thinks that the conclusion is that you ought to wager that God exists. So you ought to believe that God exists. So that's Pascal's wager. We're going to be talking about that argument tonight. We'll talk about whether or not this is a good argument for believing that God exists, and then we'll also look at some other prudential arguments, other arguments that are saying that somehow, if you're weighing the costs and benefits of belief, that it might still be more beneficial to believe in God, even if Pascal's particular sort of argument doesn't work out. But before we talk a whole lot about Pascal's argument, I'm going to start us off with some simpler cases just to get some of the key ideas in play here, and we can work our way up to more complicated cases like Pascal's. So here's a simple case. Maybe some of you will remember that old game show, Win Ben Stein's Money. I'm going to have you imagine a sort of variant of that show. So, and this show, all you have to do to win $1 million is you have to believe that Ben Stein is a beautiful woman. He has expert psychologists who will examine you. They can, you know, get out the brain scanners, whatever it takes. They can tell whether or not you believe Ben Stein is a beautiful woman. If you do believe that Ben Stein's a beautiful woman, they'll give you $1 million. Otherwise, they won't. Let me give a show of hands. How many of you think that you ought to believe that Ben Stein's a beautiful woman? A few folks here. How many of you think, no, you oughtn't believe that Ben Stein's a beautiful woman? We're getting some hands in each direction. Savvy, when I do this with SMU, I get a lot of business students in my intro philosophy classes, and they're all like, well, obviously, money's money, and you got to believe it. But I'm happy to see the Dallas Philosophers Forum is a bit more concerned with evidential reasons. Okay, so you know, ultimately, there's a sense in which each side of this debate is right, that there's a sort of reason that weighs in favor of believing that he is a beautiful woman because he can get a bunch of money. There's also a sort of reason that weighs in favor of saying, no, just look at him. You know, that his creature isn't beautiful, probably isn't a woman. You know, there's just no way it fits with their evidence. So philosophers distinguish two sorts of reasons here. So corresponding with all the evidence that we have that he's male and not beautiful, we have evidential reason not to believe that he's a beautiful woman, even positively believe that he's not a beautiful woman. But it sure would be nice to get the $1 million, and so there's what philosophers call prudential reason to believe that he is a beautiful woman, because it serves your self-interest to believe that he's a beautiful woman. You'll get the $1 million, and that's a very beneficial outcome that you could get. Lots of other examples of prudential reasons. You know, there's various sorts of evidence that suggest people who think of themselves as being taller are more likely to do well in interviews or do well speaking to public audiences. So I'm thinking of myself as being 6'4" right now. That's responding to prudential reasons. Of course, obviously, my evidence suggests I'm quite a bit shorter than that. So you get the same sort of disconnect there. So going back to Pascal was saying that as far as evidential reasons are concerned, he doesn't think there's a persuasive argument that God exists. At least his evaluation of the evidence puts it at about 50-50. Maybe other people in the room would evaluate the evidence a bit differently. But Pascal thought that evidential reason couldn't decide the question of whether or not God exists. So Pascal wanted to talk about prudential reasons to sort of sidestep the need for evidential reason. Pascal thought that you could show that it's in our self-interest to believe that God exists, even if we don't have evidence that God exists. Okay. Now, Pascal's wager differs from this simple Bernstein case in three important ways. So one difference is that in Pascal's wager, the bribe that's being, at least allegedly, offered for believing something is being offered by God, not by Ben Stein. And you might think, oh, I can trick Ben Stein's or his psychologist into thinking that I believe he's a beautiful woman, but it might be harder to trick God into thinking that you believe something that you don't actually believe. Another big difference is that in the Ben Stein case, we were just saying it was $1 million that are on the line. In the case of Pascal's wager, it seems like maybe more than that's online. It may be spending all eternity in heaven versus spending all eternity in hell. Maybe that's what's on the line, and it seems like that probably has infinite value. There's no amount of money that's as good as getting to spend an eternity in heaven, and infinity is quite a bit bigger than just $1 million, and so maybe that changes the payoff somehow. And then, of course, the third big difference is that in the Ben Stein case, we were just imagining that we knew for sure that this was how the game show works, that Ben Stein exists and offers these bribes, whereas in Pascal's wager, we don't know for sure whether or not God exists. So in the case of Pascal's wager, we need to deal with this uncertainty as we're making our choice about what to believe. Okay, so the next thing I'm going to do is take us on a short detour through decision theory. So this is a theory that people have worked out about how you can use various probabilities that you have to figure out which decisions are good ones to make. So basically, this is, you know, how to do risk analysis, how to weigh the size of the different benefits that are on the line and the probabilities of maybe getting those benefits, how to weigh those against each other to figure out which choice to make. Okay. So let's just start with a simple example. Let's suppose I offer you this deal. You can agree to flip a fair coin. If the flip is heads, you'll win $24, but if the flip is tails, you're going to lose $36. And so we can ask the question, should you agree to flip this coin? And decision theory basically says you can do this in five steps, so we'll spell it out really slowly. So one thing to do is to list the different possible ways that the world might be. In this case, there are two relevant possibilities. Either the flip is going to be tails and you'll lose $36, or the flip will be heads. So those are the two relevant possibilities here. Then we need to estimate how probable each of these two possibilities is. So if it's a fair coin, it's 50-50. There's a one-half probability that the flip will be tails, one-half probability that the flip will be heads. Then we need to ask, well, how valuable would each of these possibilities be? Well, if the flip is tails, I'm going to lose $36. If the flip is heads, I'm going to gain $24. Okay, so those are the basic numbers we need to input into the calculation, and basically the way the calculation works is we multiply each probability times the value of possibility, and then we add those products together. So let's see, a half of minus 36 is minus 18, a half of 24 is plus 12, then if we add those together, minus 18 plus 12 gives you minus 6. And this is what philosophers and economists will call the expected value of accepting this bet. You see that one way of thinking of this expected value is basically if you did this repeatedly, on average, you would lose $6 each time you did this. You know, sometimes you'd win, but other times you'd lose, and on average, you'd end up losing more than you won. On average, you'd have lost $6 each time you played. Okay. So if another option available to you is to not play at all and to get $0. Well, $0 is better than losing $6. In this case, it'd be better not to play this. Okay, so just sliding that up to give me more space. The expected value of a choice is the average value, just told you that. And it's pretty widely agreed by philosophers and economists that we have prudential reason to perform whichever available option has the highest expected value. So in this case, if another available option is just to not play at all, and that has expected value of 0, well, that's better than minus 6, so you'll have prudential reason to go with that. Okay. So there's a really simple example. Let's look at a couple of slightly more complicated examples. So one point is that it's not just the payoffs that matter, it's also the probabilities of the outcomes that matter also. So let's suppose that instead of having a fair coin, we have a coin that's weighted so that it flips heads 2/3 of the time and flips tails only 1/3 of the time. So now for doing the computation, we're going to have, a 1/3 chance of losing. So 1/3 of minus 36 is minus 12. We'll have a 2/3 chance of winning. 2/3 of 24 is 16. So if we put those together, minus 12 plus 16, our expected payoff in this case is a positive $4. On average, if you did this repeatedly with the weighted coin, you'd win on average $4 each time you played. So now it actually would be a good idea to play the game if you knew the coin was weighted this much in favor of heads. So the sort of moral of this is to say, if the payoff is small, the probability of winning has to be quite high in order for it to be a good gamble. So think about another case with a much higher payoff and much lower probability of getting the payoff. So let's say we're drawing a card from a deck of cards, and if you draw the ace of hearts, you'll get $1,000, but if you draw something else, you'll just have to have paid me $1 to play the game. So the good idea to play that game, we can work out the probabilities again. 51 out of the 52 cards would be losers, where you'd lose $1. The 1 in 52 chance, the other card, the ace of hearts, would have you win $1,000. So multiplying that out, it's roughly $18. There's a fractional amount on there that I left off. So if you did this repeatedly, on average, you'd win $18 each time you played. So it seems like this would be a pretty good game to play. If you can find somebody who will offer you $1,000 on this, it might be a good idea to play that game.
Of course, you have to play 1982 times.
Yeah, maybe. Or maybe you'll risk $1 and say, but I had a good chance. My expected value was high, even if I end up losing sometimes or a lot of the time. The good payoff still suggests one issue, that comes up, and you might worry about this, is sort of say, on average, you would get, if you managed to do this a bunch of times, there are some games where you can only claim once, and it seems like Pascal's Wager is going to be a game like that, where you're only going to die once, and so you might wonder, who cares what would happen to me on average? It's only going to happen once. Most decision theorists and economists think that even in the case where the game's only going to happen once, still the rational thing to choose is the thing that has the highest expected value, which would be the highest average payoff if you did the game repeatedly. It's hard to do that if you have to die each time you play. Or if a bunch of people all played the game, what would their average payoff be? So the moral of this example is that if the potential payoff is high enough, then it could be a good gamble, even if you're very unlikely to win. In this case, we only had a 1 in 52 chance of winning, but the payoff was so high that it still makes sense to play. Okay, now let's go one step further. This is getting us pretty close now to Pascal's Wager. Let's imagine a lottery where you have a pretty small chance of winning, but the jackpot that you would win if you do win is infinite. In this case, should you play the lottery, or how much should you be willing to pay for a ticket to play this lottery? So let's set it up. Let's say there's a very tiny chance of winning. You'll have a 99.99% chance of losing, and only a 0.01% chance of winning. And let's say the ticket costs $1,000. Basically, we can expect to lose the $1,000 most of the time when you play the game, but there's a slight chance of winning, 0.01% chance. That times infinity, infinity times any positive finite amount is still going to be infinity. So basically, we get infinity here, and it doesn't really matter what any of the other numbers were. As long as the 0.01% is more than zero, that times infinity is going to be infinity, and it doesn't matter what these other numbers multiply to, your answer is still going to be infinity. So the moral of thinking about cases like this is, if you have the chance of winning an infinite jackpot, then you should be willing to pay whatever finite price, even if it costs you $10,000 or $100,000, or you have to sell your kids into slavery, whatever it takes, an infinite jackpot is going to be worth it, even if it's only a tiny chance of winning it. The infinity is the one number that swamps all the other numbers in the calculation. Okay. So you might be wondering, is there such a thing as an infinitely valuable outcome that really should, you know, sort of dominate your thinking and swamp everything else, so you don't take anything else into consideration. It's just this one infinitely valuable thing. It seems like an infinite amount of money probably wouldn't be infinitely valuable. You know, as you amass more and more money, eventually you get to a point where you can buy anything that's of any value to you, and at that point, having more money doesn't seem to add any more value. So it seems like an infinite amount of money probably wouldn't be infinitely valuable. But you might think maybe some other things are infinitely valuable. So immortality, especially, I guess maybe it depends a bit on what your quality of life as an immortal would be, but immortality with a good quality of life, maybe that's a better prospect for actually having infinite value. And I'm not sure. It's hard for me to think about this. After, you know, 10,000 years or 100,000 years or 100 billion years of immortality, you know, would it just start to get boring? You've done everything before and there's no more value to be had by continuing your life even longer? Or would it be that, another nice glass of wine or another orgasm or whatever it is, it's still extra value even after you've had billions and billions of them already? You know, I'm not sure in that case. What to think about this. But I guess all Pascal really needs for his argument is that we allow that there's some chance that there could be an infinitely good payoff. So even if you think, well, I'm not sure whether heaven would turn out to be infinitely valuable or whether eventually I just sort of plateau and stop appreciating the additional years in heaven. As long as you allow that there's a chance that it could be infinitely valuable, that'll get you the infinity in the computation that ends up swamping all the other numbers in the computation. Okay, so that's given us basically everything we need now to go back and consider Pascal's wager. So one option that he thought is, well, we could believe that God exists. The other option is that you could believe that no God exists. Those are the two options he was considering. So we'll need to compute expected payoffs for each of those. So what's the expected payoff if you believe that God exists? Now I'm going to put numbers in here. Pascal thinks that his argument would be persuasive even to pretty strong atheists, people who think that it's really unlikely that God exists. So I'll put in numbers that the atheists would probably be pretty happy with. So, maybe some, I'm not sure how many atheists there are in the room and what the chances are, but you know, most atheists seem to allow, well, there's some chance that a God exists. Most atheists think it's a pretty small chance, and so let's go ahead and say that they think it's a 99% chance that God doesn't exist and a 1% chance that God does exist. This is a spoiler alert. It doesn't really matter what these numbers are because the infinities are going to swamp the computations. But let's go ahead and go with the atheist number, the atheist who thinks that it's 99% probable that God doesn't exist. So if I believe in God, then there's a 99% chance I'll just be wasting my time going to church. I have to get up on Sunday morning, yakka. And then, you know, putting a number on that, again, it probably doesn't really matter. Let's just say it's minus 10 utiles or whatever. Minus 10 is that, you know, what the finite costs are of having to go to church when you'd rather not. But there's a 1% chance you'll be right. And Pascal thought that if you believe in God and God does exist, just believing in God is your sort of go-to-heaven-free card. And so Pascal thought that that would give you a 1% chance of getting this infinitely good payoff by going to heaven. Okay, so putting those together, basically you get infinity times some positive number gives us an infinity. It doesn't matter what this negative number was, the result's still going to be infinity. So we get infinite expected payoff for believing in God. But what if you don't believe in God? Well, we could work out the numbers again. Again, we'll use the probabilities that many atheists would be happy with, the 99% chance that you're right in your disbelief in God. What's the payoff of that? Well, you get to sleep in or do whatever it is you like to do on Sunday morning instead of going to church, so give that some positive value. There's a 1% chance you'll turn out to be wrong, I guess you could do this with the sort of loving God who doesn't doom atheists to hell, or you could do it with the really vindictive God who dooms atheists to hell and gives them a minus infinity. Either way, you're either going to get some sort of finite number here, or maybe even a negative infinity if hell is infinitely bad. However you look at it, the expected payoff is going to be better for believing in God than it would be for not believing in God. So that's basically Pascal's wager, saying the expected payoff of believing in God, regardless of how improbable you think God's existence is, he still thinks the best bet is to believe in God. So he thinks this argument should persuade any atheist who allows there's at least a slight chance that God exists, should believe in God, because that might be their ticket to an infinite payoff, or their ticket to avoiding an infinitely bad punishment. Okay. Here it is spelled out in premises and conclusions. Philosophers like to do that. There's at least a small chance that God exists. If God exists, then theists will receive infinite rewards in heaven. So the expected value of theism is infinite. So we have prudential reason to be theists. That's basically Pascal's wager in a nutshell. So I'll talk through some responses that people have given to Pascal's wager. You know, one response is to say, well, wait a sec, I can't just believe things on command. Like, you know, in the Ben Stein case, you know, even if he offered me $1 million, I don't know how to make myself believe that he's a beautiful woman, even if I wanted to. And there might be people who feel the same way about God's existence. They might be persuaded by Pascal's wager to say, oh, it would be great if I could believe in God, but I can't just make myself believe it without evidence. Now, Pascal had a response to this, and his response was to say, well, if you can't bring yourself to believe in God's existence, then you ought to do things that'll make it easier for you eventually to believe in God's existence. So you should go to church, go through the motions, pray, count on the rosary, whatever it takes, eventually that might bring about a religious conversion and you start to get you believing in God, and then that would be your ticket for getting into heaven. This reminds me a little bit of the demotivational poster prayer, how to do nothing and still think you're helping. The philosopher at the Australian National University, Al Hayek, has pointed out, well, one upshot of Pascal's reasoning here is that there are lots of things that at least have a chance of producing a religious conversion. You could eat the magic mushrooms. That has a chance of bringing about religious conversion, so it has a chance of yielding the infinite payoff, and a chance of infinity has expected value of infinity, so the expected value of eating the magic mushrooms is the same as the expected value of praying. They both have infinite expected value, or you could go to a brothel. You know, for some of us, it may be that these things would have a better chance of bringing about religious conversion than sitting in church praying with. Okay, so this suggests, at least when I think about this, suggests that things get kind of weird once you start thinking about infinite payoffs and the way that infinities swamp all numbers and calculations. And when you start getting weird results like this, you should probably start setting up your spider senses that maybe there's just something wrong with this sort of argument if you can get weird results like this. Let's go ahead and think about some of the other objections that people have raised to Pascal's wager. So here's a cartoon that I presume was probably made by an atheist. Sorry if you have trouble reading it. The cartoonist here is saying, well, if you they start off quoting Pascal, if you gain all, if you lose nothing, and then the cartoonist is listing various exceptions, except for eating pork, or losing your foreskin, or time and energy and money that religion costs, or scientific and medical advancements, and blood transfusions that at least some religions tell you not to accept, or maybe some religions even make you give up human rights or wear things like a burqa. This cartoonist is basically saying, no, there are lots of costs to religion. It's not that you lose nothing by being religious. Instead, many people, part of this depends on which religion you choose, many people actually lose something, and maybe something quite significant due to their religion. For me, I think, this is true, at least for some religions, but I think it's kind of beside the point as far as Pascal's wager is concerned. The key idea, again, with Pascal's wager is there's this infinity in the calculation. So even these finite costs of having to be circumcised or giving up the food that you prefer or having to wear a burqa, those are just finite costs. They pale in comparison to the infinite payoff that you could get by going to heaven, so it doesn't really matter what these finite costs of religion are. So the sort of moral here is that if you think wearing a burqa gives you a chance to get infinite rewards, then you'll have prudential reason to wear a burqa, no matter how uncomfortable it is, at least as long as it's just finitely uncomfortable, you're still going to have prudential reason to do it to increase your chance of getting into heaven. But when I look around the room, I don't actually see anybody wearing a burqa here, and I think, you know, probably all of us accept that, well, there's some chance that the Muslims, the conservative Muslims, are right, that wearing a burqa actually is a requirement, at least for women to get into heaven, and yet nobody here is wearing a burqa. What's up with that? And this is sort of highlighting another real issue with Pascal's wager is, you know, Pascal was presuming that he knew what God would reward, that he thought believing in God's existence, that's what gets rewarded by God. But we know lots of people have different beliefs about what God might reward, and we aren't sure which God you have to believe in order to get rewarded, and we aren't sure you know, whether it's even just belief in that God that God would reward rather than good behavior or doing whatever weird things that God wants you to do. And so one of the key things that Pascal needs, and I think it was P2 in the argument I put up before, is this assumption about what will be rewarded. And one of the real worries about Pascal's wager is, you know, what will be rewarded? How do we know what's going to be rewarded? One of the things I really liked about the Calvin and Hobbes cartoon I started off with is that Bill Watterson in the cartoon did a great job of bringing out this worry about Pascal's wager. And he actually did it in two ways. So he had Hobbes point out that, well, Calvin's and Pascal's reasoning here is really sort of cynically enterprising reasoning. Calvin says it's the spirit of Christmas, but you know, we all recognize that's not really the spirit of Christmas. You know, lots of religions don't say just believe in God because it's a great way of getting great rewards. Instead, many religions suggest, you know, really what you need to do is do good works. Do things not because it's in your own self-interest, but because you're selfishly interested in other people. And so it's not at all clear that this sort of reasoning, the reasoning that Pascal advises, actually would be the ticket into heaven. You know, it depends on what God's into, but you know, a lot of people suspect that God wouldn't actually be into this sort of selfish reasoning. And it might even be that God would punish people who believe purely on the basis of selfish self-interest. The cartoon also points out that, well, Calvin says, my presents, lots of presents. Heck, I'll believe anything they want. And that's another sort of nice observation about this argument is, you know, there's nothing in particular about this argument that leads to the conclusion that God exists. You know, there are lots of other sorts of beliefs that could potentially yield infinite rewards, and you can make a Pascal's wager style argument for lots of other beliefs. And that includes potentially even atheism. So just for fun, let's look at how a Pascal's wager style argument for atheism would go. So Pascal's wager, let's make this be the atheist wager, and let's go ahead and put an evil mustache on that Pascal there. So first premise here, there's at least a small chance that instead of talking about God, let's talk about, I think Stephen Colbert does this, Yahweh or Nahweh, but a small chance that Nahweh exists. Who's Nahweh? Well, Nahweh is this sort of reclusive deity who doesn't want people to believe in him. And if you believe in Nahweh, then he sends you to hell for all eternity. Whereas if you don't believe in Nahweh, well, that's what Nahweh likes, is people not believing in him. And so he lets the non-believers into heaven. After all, they get infinitely good rewards. So even if you're pretty confident that Yahweh exists rather than Nahweh, you've got to allow that there's at least some chance that Nahweh exists. In fact, probably the evidence that we have, our world looks quite a bit more like a world with a reclusive God who wants people not to believe in him, rather than a world that has a sort of a vain, greedy God who really wants everybody to believe in him. You know, you think if we have this sort of vain Yahweh who exists, you know, maybe you would expect to see more evidence of his existence than we do, and so maybe, if anything, our probability for Yahweh's existence should be a little higher than our probability for Yahweh's existence. But, you know, all this argument really needs is that it's non-zero, that it's above zero. There's at least some chance that Yahweh exists. If Yahweh exists, then theists will receive, no, not theists, Yahweh rewards the atheists rather than the theists. If Yahweh exists, then atheists will receive infinite rewards in heaven. So the expected value of atheism is infinite, So we all have prudential reason to be atheists. It seems like this argument, you know, if Pascal's wager was a good argument for theism, this should be an equally good argument for atheism. And generally in philosophy, whenever you have equally good arguments for contradictory conclusions, that's a clear sign that the arguments are actually both equally bad arguments. So the sternness that we're getting, you know, Pascal's wager, you know, just doesn't work out, because you can give the same sort of argument for lots of different conclusions. They can't all be right. I won't talk through this, but you can work out the same sort of calculations where you have a 1% chance of, or whatever small chance of ending up getting to hell because you believed in God when Nali didn't want you to, and some chance of getting to heaven because you disbelieved and that's what Nali rewards. So we get the same sort of structure of argument that we had before. Okay, so the key thing that's going on here is basically, whatever you believe, there's a slight possibility that some deity exists who rewards people who believe that thing. So there's a slight possibility of getting a plus infinite payoff for whatever it is that you've done, but also for whatever it is that you've done, you're opening yourself to a slight possibility that some sort of deity exists who disapproves of people who do that or believe that, and gives you a minus infinite payoff for that. And so if you're going to take into account all the different possible costs and benefits of the things that you're doing, and you're taking these infinite costs and benefits into account, then it turns out that the computations are always going to involve taking plus infinity and combining that together with minus infinity, and probably most of you know from math classes that there really isn't a well-defined way of doing that, that infinities, you can't just add and subtract them with each other. If we were going to have prudential reason to believe in the existence of some deity because of the infinite rewards that we were hoping to get by believing in that deity, we'd need to have evidential reason to rule out all the other deities who might punish us for having that belief instead. So Pascal had hoped to sort of, you know, do a side run around the need for evidential reason. Let's not worry about what the evidence says. Let's just give this prudential argument to persuade atheists that they ought to believe in God's existence after all. Well, it turns out, no, you're actually going to need evidential reason to decide this debate after all. Okay, so summarizing this big problem here, without knowing what deities might exist and what they would reward, we can't calculate the expected value of different beliefs. If we were going to have prudential reason to believe in God, we would first need evidential reason that God would reward theism, and especially theism based in this selfish way. And we'd also need evidential reason to completely rule out the existence of other gods who would punish you for that belief instead. Again, we can't sidestep the need for evidential reason using an argument like Pascal's wager. So what's causing these problems for Pascal's wager? It seems like there are two things that are they're really contributing here that are making Pascal's wager not work. One is including infinite values in the computations, and as we've seen, you get all these weird results, like the Al Hayek results where eating the magic mushrooms gets you the same infinite expected payoff as the other things do, the infinity is swamping all the other numbers in the computation, so even if you think there's a real tiny chance that Nawe exists, still a tiny chance of infinity is just as big an infinity as the other infinities are. Maybe one of the problems here is just talking so much about infinite values. So maybe we should do away with infinite values. It might just be that decision theory doesn't work with infinite values, and so maybe rational agents shouldn't ever actually assign completely infinite value to anything. That would avoid at least lots of the messes that Pascal-style reasoning was leading us into. Another sort of potential solution here is, or I guess the cause of the problems here is, you know, once you take into account all the different possible deities and all the different things that they might possibly reward, when you have all these possibilities in the computations, then it becomes really hard to figure out what the result is, or impossible even if you're having plus and minus infinities in the computation. So if we could find evidence that rules out the existence of some of these deities, that would make the computation simpler to work out. Or if we had evidence that could let us put precise numbers. There's a 12% chance that this sort of deity exists, and a 6% chance that that sort of deity exists. And if we could quantify the value of the sort of afterlife that the different deities would offer, then that would give us more potential way of using Pascal-style reasoning to figure out which deities we have prudential reason to believe in order to maximize our chances of getting the best sort of afterlife. But again, Pascal was hoping to sidestep our need to dig into the evidence here, whereas this sort of way out of the mess he got us into really requires us to dig down and consider what the evidence is. And that's outside the scope of this talk. And another sort of option here is maybe just sort of throw up your hands and say, it's just too hard. We don't know what sorts of deities might exist. We don't know what things they might reward. We don't have enough evidence to try to make choices here and now in hopes of getting a better afterlife. We just have no idea what effects our choices here and now might make on what sort of afterlife we're going to have. But maybe you could still do prudential reasoning involving the sorts of more tangible payoffs and costs that we actually have pretty good evidence of in the here and now. So in the last few minutes of the talk, I'm going to go ahead and talk a bit about some of those more tangible here and now evidence. And largely this is a sort of empirical question. I'll start off with ad hominem arguments, whatever. This is the argumentum ad cartoonum. So we can consider cartoons that people on each side give in this debate. So I put this one up earlier where this cartoonist was saying, well, here are all these costs that they think belief in God comes with. And I mentioned before, well, if you have infinities in the calculation, the infinities are going to swamp all these costs. But now we're imagining, well, let's set aside these concerns about the afterlife and just figure out which beliefs have the best payoffs in the here and now. So this cartoonist is suggesting, well, religion has a lot of costs associated with it. And so if you're trying to balance costs and benefits, it seems like these are going to be a bunch of factors that weigh in favor of being an atheist rather than being a theist. Continuing the arguments ad cartoonum, here's a cartoon that I'm presuming is made by a theist, saying, what are the rewards of being an atheist? And they have a person sitting alone in a room. So I guess this cartoonist didn't think there were very many rewards to be had for atheists. And so you're sort of weighing the costs of being religious versus the costs of being an atheist, and maybe it's hard to tell which way the scales would balance out. Now, when I think about these arguments, I guess I'm inclined to say, yes, some religions do have significant costs of these sorts, but not all religions do. I teach at a nominally Methodist university, and Methodists don't put any of these restrictions. I mean, I guess they ask for money, but they don't, come hunt you down if you don't tithe at this church. So these sorts of costs don't really apply to Methodism or to lots of other denominations also. So it's not clear to me that actually all these costs really, maybe they weigh against choosing some religions, but there are lots of other religions that you could choose that wouldn't have these costs. So I don't take these costs to be all that decisive in this debate. So just gritty them out a little bit here. What about the other cartoon argument, the rewards of being an atheist? Pulled this picture off of the meetup page for Fellowship of Free Thought, which is a Dallas group for atheists, and that's so some pub night or something that they had getting together, and it actually looks like they're having a lot more fun than the guy sitting alone in the room had. So it's not clear that being an atheist is actually as dismal as that cartoonist had in mind, so I'm inclined to say that probably wasn't all that persuasive of an argument either. So it seems like really what we need here is sort of good, hard, empirical evidence. Is there good evidence suggesting that theists live longer or happier than atheists are, or is there good evidence in the other direction? So like to have empirical evidence, and ultimately a philosopher is not the right person to ask for empirical evidence. I'm good at reasoning things in my armchair. this empirical evidence, you might want to ask a sociologist or a psychologist. But you know, I tried to look into it out of interest. It turns out that it's a great big mess. There are lots of studies out there, and a lot of the studies seem to contradict one another. It's pretty clear that a lot of the studies were performed by people who had an axe to grind, who were trying to find support for which one they thought was better. There's also people have done meta-studies on this, and there's also evidence of a sort of publication bias that you have to have interesting, shocking results or else the journal won't publish it. And so a lot of the studies that have been done on this stuff actually don't end up being published because they didn't weigh in the direction that the journal wanted the results to weigh before they would publish it. So a lot of this stuff, you know, it's really hard to make sense of the empirical evidence on this. And because of that, you maybe should take some of what I say with a grain of salt here, though I'm going to be trying to pick out the stuff that was striking to me and seemed to be coming up and be pretty well attested. So, and I'm going to bring up some of the results on each side of these debates. So one sort of research that lots of folks have done is questions about are theists or atheists healthier? Are they expected to live longer than the other group? And also there are studies about whether or not they're happier than each other. And so here are some of the results. One of the results that it seems like pretty much everybody agrees on is that people who live in secular places tend to be happier and healthier than people who live in more religious places. So if you think about first world countries versus third world countries tend to be very, very religious. First world countries tend to be quite a bit less religious, and it's in lots of ways a lot better to live in a first world country, you know, in terms of longevity or reports of happiness than it is to live in a third world country. Even if you limit the focus to just first world countries, still if you look at the ones that are least religious, like Scandinavian, Northern European countries, they measure up better on longevity measures and on happiness reports than more religious countries like the U.S. do. If you focus in more and look at different states within the U.S., the states with the highest longevity and the highest reports of happiness are quite secular states like Massachusetts and Oregon. The states with the lowest longevity and the lowest reports of happiness are highly religious states like Mississippi and Tennessee, and Texas is right down there. So it seems like there are lots of ways in which secular places are better places to live. But it is sort of tricky. I guess probably most of you know that correlation isn't the same thing as causation. There are lots of different hypotheses that you might have. I suppose some atheists might think that atheists make for happier places, but there are other hypotheses here. It could be that if you live in really miserable conditions, you're more likely to get into religion as a sort of way out of the misery that you're in, and so that's why we see this sort of correlation. Or it could be that there's some common cause in the background. There's pretty good evidence that education correlates strongly with atheism, and that educated people tend to live longer and to be happier, at least in some ways. And so maybe there's some common cause in the background that's causing these things. So it's not clear that you can draw the conclusion from the fact that more secular places tend to be happier that it would be that you would be happier in the place where you live if you yourself were atheist rather than being atheist. Okay, so I'm not sure this really weighs all that strongly in favor of atheism, but it's interesting results, and if you're looking for results that most people agree on, they agree on that there at least being this correlation. On the flip side, there's pretty strong evidence that people who go to church live longer than people who don't go to church. And that might sound like a sort of argument that you ought to go to church, but again, the correlation-causation thing, once you think about this, that there is this correlation here. Really, what this amounts to saying is that sick people go out less than well people are likely to live long do. And so that's not exactly a newsflash after all. And it turns out that engaging in secular social activity has the same positive effects on longevity and happiness that church attendance does. And it turns out that various private religious things like praying at home or doing rituals with beads or whatever, those don't correlate with living longer. So basically, I think most of this data is just showing that being healthy and social and happy all correlate with one another, and it doesn't have anything to do with whether your social activities are religious ones or secular ones. So I don't think this sort of evidence ends up weighing all that strongly in favor of belief in God. It does weigh in favor of getting out and being social somehow or other, but not necessarily in a religious way. Okay. Some other data, there's quite strong data that, at least in the U.S., that atheists face various sorts of discrimination. So various surveys where you ask how much do you trust various groups of people, atheists are way down there, sometimes just below Muslims, sometimes just above Muslims, ranking down around where pedophiles are, about they, you know, how trusted and well-liked people are. And so, you know, there's pretty strong evidence that that atheists aren't the, you know, aren't the best liked of all groups in America. There's the surveys where you ask people, you know, regardless of qualifications, even if the person was really well-qualified, if they were an atheist, would you vote for them for president? Roughly half of Americans say, no, if they're atheist, I won't vote for them. Doesn't matter how well qualified they are. Quite a few state constitutions, including the Texas state constitution. The Texas constitution says there's no religious requirement for office as long as you believe in an almighty being. But no guarantees if you don't. So you know, in some states like ours, this is even a legal requirement for getting into office. I'm not sure whether Texas actually enforces that or whether it's just a relic of days gone by that they've never gotten around to changing. One interesting sort of study in this one, they asked people, which of these people who need a kidney transplant would you rank most highly? And they, as the person that ought to get the kidney transplant first, and then, you know, they had various factors in there, but what they varied in the experiment was whether the person was described as being an atheist or being a theist, and people would rank somebody much higher if they're described as being a theist, even if the rest of their description is the same, as somebody who's a better candidate for receiving an organ transplant than an atheist would be. So that's another, you know, I'm not sure how much, you know, that was, you know, in an experiment. I'm not sure how much that actually affects atheists in real life, but it's another sign of the sort of way in which atheists are discriminated against. And so if you're thinking about prudential reasons to either believe in God or not believe in God, you know, these are factors that probably are prudential factors that weigh in favor of belief in God. And, you know, I haven't seen data on this, but sort of anecdotally, I know quite a few atheists, and many of them will say things like, you know, when I came out to my family about being an atheist, they disowned me. And I haven't seen studies on this, but that certainly is going to be a prudential reason not to come out to your family about being an atheist if you care about having family support. So it seems like there are lots of sorts of factors here that probably are prudential factors that, at least for many people, would weigh in favor of being a theist. Okay, go ahead and get us a last fun sort of data here, and I'm not sure if this is just because I like reading about sex on the internet, or, you know, it actually is probably a pretty good place to look, where if you think about many religions have various sorts of restrictions on what sort of sex people are supposed to be having and stuff like that, whereas most atheists tend to have the attitude, as long as you're consenting adults, and taking appropriate sorts of precautions, they're much more laissez-faire about what sorts of sex people can have. So it turns out that there are actually studies, I guess lots of people are into studying sex, lots of studies looking at sex differences, you know, differences in sex behavior and the psychology of sex between atheists and theists. And so here are some of the results that come up there. Atheists tend to have more sexual partners in their lifetime than theists do. For various positions, kind of linguists is probably one of the strongest ones of these, that atheists do a lot more of that, so ladies. studies report more sexual satisfaction by atheists and less guilt associated with the sex that they're having. surprisingly, despite having more sex and more kinky sex, apparently, atheists have lower STD transmission rates. They tend to be better about using protection. This makes sense where if you're doing sort of abstinence-only sex education as your religiously driven sex education, that ends up being less good at, it doesn't stop people from having sex, but it does make them less good at using protection. Also there's data in this, there's some older studies that seem to point in the other direction, but multiple more recent studies that show that atheists have slightly lower rates of divorce. And again, that's interesting. Questions about correlation and causation here may well just be because atheists tend to be more educated and get married at a later age or something like that. But at any rate, atheists have lower divorce rates. So here's a variety of things that depending on what sorts of payoffs you're most interested in, you might take to weigh a bit in the direction of being an atheist rather than being an atheist. Okay. So let me go ahead and wrap this up with a few conclusions. So one thing that we saw is the decision theory breaks down when we have infinite values. We get all these weird results, like eating the magic mushrooms has just as good a payoff as things that are more closely tied to religion. Also, given all the different possible deities that we can imagine, it seems like if we're going to do any sort of prudential reasoning involving an afterlife, we need to really delve into the evidence as to which sorts of beliefs are going to be most likely to be rewarded and which sorts of beliefs are most likely to be punished. Depending on whether you think you can find this sort of evidence, you may or may not be able to make these arguments, but at any rate, you aren't going to be able to do this sort of sidestepping maneuver that Pascal hoped to do, where we don't even need to look at the evidence at all. You can just tell that we should believe in God's existence. That's what Pascal hoped for. I just don't think that you can do that. You're going to have to look at some sort of evidence. I didn't want to delve into the evidence or arguments for or against different sorts of God's existence today, but I did look at some of the evidence about more tangible here and now benefits. It seems pretty clear that we live in a country, and especially in a state here in Texas, where it can be fairly rough to be an atheist, or really any sort of non-Christian. Muslims have it pretty much as bad as atheists do. So there's a lot to be said for just going with the flow, and especially if being religious is already working pretty well for you, then there's probably prudential reason to keep with what's working. So there's at least some sort of prudential reason, I think, for some people, especially somebody who's old and draws lots of comfort from their religion. As far as I can tell, prudential reason weighs in favor of them continuing with their religion until they die. But perhaps more surprisingly for some theists, it turns out that at least as far as the data are concerned, many atheists end up having similarly happy lives, and at least in some ways, even more so, ladies. It seems like that at least for some people, there might actually be a prudential reason that weighs in favor of being an atheist rather than being a theist. And of course, for many of us, and especially probably an audience that self-selected to come to a philosophy forum, a lot of us probably just aren't that interested in prudential reasons anyway. Speaking for myself, I'd rather believe what's true and what fits my evidence rather than what gets me laid a bit more or whatever. So it may be that for lots of us, all these prudential reasons pale in comparison to evidential reasons, which are really the sorts of reasons that many of us would rather form our beliefs around. So people like that probably weren't going to be all that persuaded by Pascal's wager considerations anyway. Okay, so there's some conclusions. Let's open this up to questions.
I would just ask that you keep your statements relatively short before you get into your question.
One of the things that I guess has always bothered me is I guess the whole concept of prudential reason for a belief. I have difficulty in reconciling the idea of, and I think you alluded to this somewhat, deciding to believe something. Uh-huh. I mean, belief is something that's is there as a result of your experience or what you've been told or how you've been brainwashed or whatever, but not sort of some analytic decision, oh, it's good for me to believe. One could say that a lot of the advantages of being a theist or disadvantages of being an atheist would be put in terms of holding yourself out to be a theist, or you know, presenting yourself as being a theist, and then you enjoy the advantages that accrue to being a theist, and something like Texas,
yeah,
for example.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree that a lot of the considerations I was raising there, especially the ones involving discrimination, and I think probably it is the case with lots of politicians, you know, they just need to pretend to be theists in order to get elected. It's not because they actually believe in God, and you can see in lots of their behavior that there's pretty good sign that they probably don't actually believe in God, but they just need to behave as though they do, and so maybe that some of these prudential considerations weigh more in favor of behaving a particular way. There is lots of debate in philosophy about, you know, I guess the label for the debate is voluntarism, the view that you can sort of choose what beliefs to hold, and lots of people are involuntarists about belief. They think that, no, you just end up believing things. You can't choose what to believe. And you know, Pascal was being sensitive to that when he was saying, well, if you can't just bring yourself to believe in God's existence, what you ought to do is make choices that will indirectly bring it about, but eventually you'll believe in God's existence. And it seems like for lots of these considerations, if you end up being persuaded, yeah, I want to be one of those happy atheists at the bar, and you know, too bad I currently believe in God, well, maybe if I go hang out with the atheists, I'll end up being one of the happy atheists eventually, something like that. So you might take all these prudential reasons to be pushing more in favor of behaving in certain ways rather than directly believing in certain ways.
So Pascal, we consider two different philosophers, Voltaire and Bakunin. I'm wondering if you thought about rephrasing a lot of investigations in terms of what they said, because Voltaire said that if God didn't exist, it'd be necessary to invent him, whereas Bakunin had said if God did exist, it'd be necessary to destroy him. And I'm wondering whether you thought about that in terms of maybe social optimality and in terms of that sort of thing, as opposed to individual profit maximization and that sort of thing.
Yeah. Another sort of topic that there's some research on is, you know, how do people behave differently if they believe that God exists or if they believe that God doesn't exist? And there's a sort of conventional thought among many theists that if atheism became popular, then civilization would break down, that, you know, if people stopped worrying that God was looking over their shoulders or threatening to punish them with hell, then they'd stop behaving very well. At least as far as the evidence involving people's actual behavior is concerned, it seems like the evidence doesn't really support that. For things like criminality, that's correlated with theism rather than with atheism. And again, there's lots of issues about correlation and causation here. It may well be that being wealthier is correlated with atheism, and being poorer is correlated with criminality. And so maybe that's what's driving this. But at any rate, there isn't evidence that suggests that people will end up behaving a whole lot worse if they disbelieve in God than how they would behave if they do believe in God. The strongest evidence I've seen in this ballpark is many religious people donate to charities to their churches, and rates of donation tend to be lower among atheists than they tend to be among theists. And so that's the strongest sort of evidence that there might be, that without churches, probably people would donate less to charity. And so there's a sort of worry that maybe we would need to invent God's existence in order to get people to donate more to charity. On the other hand, atheists tend to vote more for government programs that serve the same purposes that charities do than theists do. So it may be that atheists just have in mind different solutions to the same problems that theists have. I hadn't thought, I guess honestly, I teach this as a topic in my intro philosophy class, because my intro students like philosophy of religion. It's easy to engage them talking about that. And then when I was invited to give a talk here, I was like, oh, well, what topic do I have that I think this audience would enjoy? And I already had slides for this, so I said, sure, I'll give this talk. I'm not sure I'm planning to publish anything on this. If I was, looking into more of these figures definitely would be a good way to go.
Question back here. Jason, always entertained and enlightened listening to you talk, and I just wonder how good this lecture would have been if you really believed you were 6'4".
No answer.
Okay. I was just hoping you wasn't seeing the clown shoes that I was wearing.
I have a mundane question first. I have a bill here. For iced tea and crispy meat taco dinner, does that belong to someone? And please claim it if it does. And my other question for you is, at the time of Blaise Pascal in the 17th century, early 17th century, people in Europe liked to gamble a lot. They were really big gamblers on the Dutch bolts and that sort of thing. And so he presented this argument as a gamble, as a wager, because he liked it. He knew who his audience was. And he presented it in this way, that you believe there was no evidential proof one way or the other, and that he was a Jansenist and didn't believe in, you know, the Thomism, you know, proof of God. You know, we couldn't prove it one way or the other. So if we wager, yes or no, okay, and we're right, yes, then we gain everything, and for long we lose nothing. And on the other hand, if we say no, and we lose everything, but gain nothing. So if you put it in that perspective, wouldn't this have more strength in your argument? One way, you know, if you know.
I don't think that gets around the what I was calling the big problem before, the worry about what would be rewarded, and it seems like you may be going through this reasoning and deciding, yeah, I'm going to believe that God exists because I want lots of loot or lots of great afterlife. Maybe that would end up being my ticket to heaven, but maybe God would look at me and say, you selfish bastard, go straight to hell. You know, you'd have to know that this actually was the sort of thing that would get rewarded in order for this to give you prudential reason to believe on this basis, and we don't know that. We don't have any evidence that mere belief in God is what would get us into heaven rather than lots of other things that might instead be what deities end up rewarding instead.
Question here. Would we say that the prudential argument tends to be more of a naturalistic bent argument? Because the whole framework is more of what we would receive in this life. It seems to assume naturalism. If we are saying, though, from the Judeo-Christian belief, that the whole purpose of the life is to have free will creatures freely choose God, then to choose only by looking at what the naturalistic causes would be, it wouldn't be a valid argument in that aspect.
Yes, so after I sort of pointed out the big problem worries and trying to figure out, well, what's making Pascal's argument not work? Is it the infinities? Is it that there are too many possible deities that we need to take into consideration? We just don't have enough evidence to tell us which of those are. You know, it could be that the right response here is, well, let's find good evidence as to what deities exist, and I'm not sure whether that pursuit would presume naturalism, or, you know, I don't think it would presume naturalism, and so when I went into, well, what are the here and now benefits, I was saying, well, let's set aside the questions about the afterlife, because without delving into that evidence, which would take a whole other talk or multiple other talks, we aren't going to be able to settle the prudential questions about which beliefs are going to pay off best in the afterlife. But maybe we do have good evidence about what pays off best in the here and now. Once you start focusing on that, it seems like you can do that from a much more naturalistic perspective, where you can just ask the scientists, you know, who lives longest, and it seems like you don't need to believe in anything supernatural to ask those sorts of questions. So it seems like as far as just asking what pays off best in the here and now, that you could probably do from a purely naturalistic standpoint.
Well, now, I would say if we do take on the position of an atheistic or a naturalistic viewpoint, then I think the conclusion has to be that it would be more beneficial to live without the viewpoint of a god. Because if there is no afterlife, then this is the only opportunity we have. And so all of the prudential reasons should lean towards it being better in this life rather than an afterlife perspective. I think the only thing that brings value to whether or not there is prudential evidence in this life for it is whether or not there is an afterlife.
Yeah, I guess, you know, just putting cards on the table, I don't believe in any gods. But I'm inclined to say that it isn't obvious. You know, before you look into the evidence, it could turn out that belief in God provides a sort of psychological solace to people that does help to improve their health and well-being and happiness in various ways. So to me, before looking into the evidence, it was an open question whether theists might turn out to be happier and more long-lived. Once you look at the evidence, it turns out, no, they don't. They're just people like everybody else is, and things like being social contribute a lot to happiness and longevity, but what you believe about invisible deities doesn't really affect happiness and longevity. That's what the data end up supporting, but for me, it wasn't a foregone conclusion that that's what they would support.
Okay, Dr. Fisher, we have time for two more questions.
Knowing that Pascal is highly educated and knowing about monotheism and polytheism, how do you feel that he was affected by monotheism, organized religion, and the effect of the small communities that affected philosophers back in that day?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, and I'm not a historian of philosophy, and I'm not an expert on Pascal. I think it's pretty obvious that he wasn't thinking a lot about polytheism, because as soon as you put extra possibilities into your calculations and say, well, what if Jesus was right versus what if Muhammad was right? As soon as you add those into your calculations, then you end up recognizing that, well, maybe accepting Christ as my personal savior, if it turns out that Muhammad was right, maybe that's dooming me to hell, or maybe it's getting me to heaven. So as soon as you're accepting, you're entertaining multiple hypotheses about different sorts of deities that might exist, then the computations immediately break down. So it's pretty clear that the only two options he was considering were Christian monotheism and an atheism. And as soon as you start entertaining more possibilities, his arguments break down entirely. Now, as to why he was limiting his consideration to just those two options, I couldn't say.
Okay, so he answered your question?
Yeah, he pretty much answered my question right there. I was pretty much just going to ask, because there's so many different viewpoints of so many different religions, because you have... for example, you have things that are going in the Middle East like ISIS and Al-Qaeda and Taliban, and make you think through their viewpoint, that's how they get into heaven, by doing all that. And then you have the extremist other opinion of the very same religion that was the same viewpoint, they had to be peaceful, they had to be friendly to others, and that's how you get into heaven. And it's pretty much the question I was having is what you just answered was, how would you really measure that if you don't really know? If you want to go into heaven, if you don't really know or agree with what your God wants, how would you know how to get into heaven if you don't even know exactly what you need to do to get into heaven?
Good. Yeah, so something I've said at several points in the talk, I guess it's this thing right down here, is to say that ultimately if you're wanting to consider, well, how do my choices affect what sort of afterlife I'm going to get? I did that, sorry. How do my choices affect what sort of afterlife I'm going to get? You'd want evidence as to what sorts of gods are likely to exist, how probable it is that they exist, how probable it is that they would punish us for different sorts of things. There's tons and tons of philosophical debate about how to weigh evidence for and against different sorts of gods' existence. In this talk, I didn't have time to go into those sorts of issues. I guess just to say a little bit about it, I guess my own view is that the evidence weighs pretty strongly against any sort of God's existence that fits any of the sort of major monotheistic depictions of God as being extremely powerful, extremely interested in our lives, extremely loving towards us.
It seems to me, you know, the problem of evil considerations are things don't go as well for us as they would if we had that powerful of an invisible friend looking out for us. So I think the evidence weighs pretty strongly against that sort of God's existence. Now, weaker gods or more disinterested gods or deist sort of gods that started the universe and then have had a hands-off attitude ever since, I think it's a lot harder to say what the evidence says about those sorts of gods' existence, and I don't think we have any evidence that tells us at all about if that sort of God existed, what they'd be likely to reward. So for me, this thought of trying to second guess, you know, what the desires would be of some sort of deity that may or may not exist, to me it just seems like a hopeless cause. We don't have nearly enough evidence. You know, I think there's a chance that some deity like that exists. So in some sense, technically I'm agnostic. But I think it's just hopeless to try to second guess what their desires for us would be.
There may be no reward.
Yeah, maybe that there is no reward to be given, and maybe there is some sort of rewards that they would give us, but trying to guess what things they would reward, you know, who knows?
We are out of time, and let's give a round.